You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. So welcome indeed. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast, today featuring Tony Law. It's Tony's second appearance on the show. He made quite an infamous appearance a couple of years ago in which he was in a state of advanced refreshment. And we will be talking about that now that he is no longer refreshing himself. Tony is going to go into some more detail about that, and we'll talk about the way he's refined his work and his life since then. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff. I don't know whether to recommend you listen to that first episode first, because I feel like I should as a broadcaster, because I think it was really fascinating. And it isn't as bad as Tony thinks, as he explains he hasn't heard it. But he was certainly a bit all over the place, and listeners have had very contrasting opinions on that episode. So part of me thinks you should have a listen to it if you haven't already. But also, out of respect for Tony, if he'd rather to kind of close that chapter, then maybe just start from here. So listen to this one, see what you think, and then make your own decision. But this is the fabulous Tony Law.
Yeah. There were good bits. And when we saw... I've listened back to it just now. I wasn't going to, because I know that you haven't heard it. But I sort of thought lots of the listeners of this show have heard it.
Yeah.
And there were definite good bits. And I will ask you... I wasn't sure how serious you were being.
Okay,
and there
sure.
was some quite fun friction. I don't know how much you remember of doing it, even.
Not at
there
all.
There was a bit where you called me a prick, but it was...
Really?
It was kind of in quite a friendly way. I was sort of...
I must have been joking.
I think you were.
Oh,
I think you were. I think it made some of my listeners a tiny bit angry.
Really?
Yeah, but I think
fair
you were.
Enough.
I think you were. Because, of course, like you and me, we don't have huge amounts of history, but we've gigged together.
Yeah,
we've
yeah,
done
yeah.
A couple
we've
of
always
road
been
trips
friendly.
And stuff like that.
Oh, I can't.
Yeah, yeah. So
yeah,
I
see, there's why I don't.
it was nice.
Sorry.
I think I called you on something. You were talking about not liking observational comics, and I accused you of being an observational comic by stealth. And you
I sure am. That's absolutely true. I am. Yeah, I would talk a lot of shit, usually just to get some sort of reaction and stuff like that, I think. But, of course I am. I'm an... But if I did say prick, it would be in that sort of drunky banter way. Yeah, you prick!
It was a bit more like that.
Yeah, but still, like no that. Need for it.
Well,
I called my son a prick once.
Oh, how old is your son?
7.
Oh.
Yeah. But with a smile, so...
So listen, before we get into the nitty-gritty...
Uh-oh, yep.
How much are you performing at the moment? How much are you kind of... I'm aware that, like, when you and I... And I might not have made this explicit in the preamble for this show, but this is... You're under no... Like, I'm not interested in you being funny.
Oh,
at the
cool.
moment, for the sake of this.
Yeah.
And I know that there are some comics, and Tom Stades springs to mind. He was used as an example recently in an interview I did with Paul Curry about, he was used as an example of, like, no one's really themselves on stage and off stage, apart from Tom Stade.
Right, yeah.
I think there is a sort of a seam of, we all recognise in other comics, people who are kind of
yeah.
doing their persona at all times.
Right.
How, like, when we yeah. talked about doing this, we saw each other at that gig in Soho yeah. House. Remember that slightly weird gig we
oh,
did?
Oh, yes, yes, upstairs, yeah.
It was pre-Edinburgh. Everyone was yeah. shitting themselves. Yeah. There were maybe 12 people in.
Yeah.
It actually got quite
lovely
nice.
Lovely time, yeah.
It was surprisingly nice.
Yeah.
But the level at which we spoke to each other then
yeah.
was a kind of really talking to each other thing. And I'm keen for us to do that.
Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I think once I started, when I got sober and all of that, I was still mentally not very strong for a long time. And it's been like a fog slowly lifting and self-esteem and confidence slowly building. So I was very good at presenting a face for a long time of, you know, hey, I was a bit of a character all the time. Yeah. And so when I got sober, I think I was showing more kind of vulnerability and, you know, like... scrambling around, hey, not really knowing exactly how much you're supposed to share with people.
Yeah.
Like, not really knowing how to be. so being too sherry with the wrong people sometimes. And then now just sort of getting a balance and then going, oh, yeah, no, I trust that person. I'll just say this and ask how they're doing. Yeah, and it's vocabulary, though, and the damage done to the short-term memory... I can't I lose my train of thought quite a bit. Anyways, what was the question? My character. Yeah, I pretty much it comes and goes. I'm a bit of a mixed bag, I think.
Okay.
I think I'm quite a lot like I am on stage all the time. I don't show this sensitive side, the scaredy side too much on stage, I don't think. Oh, more of it's coming out. Yeah, I think I'm like that.
We will be able to hear throughout the rest of this interview when you're calm and when you're not, because you're wearing quite a noisy top. I'm not going to ask you to take it off, but it's the difference between you moving and going, yeah, I suppose this, and then you kind of stopped and went, right.
Yeah.
So let's try and stay in that mode.
This mode here, yeah, but I get excited too, like when I move around, when I get happy.
Yeah.
So, and I'm always happy if I'm having a laugh or making people laugh, like all the time. So if I, and I'm always trying to get my kids to laugh, and if I can get them laughing, that feels good. And if I get my wife laughing and just always getting a laugh to an annoying degree, probably. I've always been trying to get a laugh. So when I'd sign DVDs after the show, I still keep going.
Yeah.
Still bantering, still trying to get people smiling, make people feel relaxed. It's like a compulsion to make people feel relaxed. They're in a queue. And no one likes being in a queue. You feel awkward. So I try and just keep going, trying to make everyone feel, hey, you know, we're all, make everyone feel welcome and friends, you know?
And do you recognize that is a bit compulsive?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Always want to make people not feel bad about anything. Very compulsive, yeah. Annoying, I suppose. Could be, I think, sometimes. Yeah, because then I... vacillate? Or
yeah,
I don't know. Shake, you know, where I swing the other way,
yeah.
Where I love driving so much because I'm just alone.
Yeah.
Because everything's a show. And when you're parenting, it's a show. Because you need to give them... I need to show them a guy who's got his shit together. Like, I got that line from listening to a Sean Locke DVD... Whereas they're like, you can't do stuff at home. You need to show, they want to see that you got your shit together.
Yeah.
That's another thing I've started to do. As I never watched comedy for years and years and years. I don't know why. It was like just, I couldn't bear it. Not because I wouldn't find it funny, but maybe because I never felt I was firing on 100%, or I never felt I was giving the best I could be, because I felt like I was always running at 20% brain capacity or soul capacity, because I knew what I was doing to myself, even if I was hiding it from people. I knew, and I know. So since I've stopped, I'm just not scared of anything. It's been the greatest thing that's ever happened to me and my family. But I go, oh, I'm in a petrol station. There's Sean Locke's DVD. I got to get that. You know, why wouldn't you want? And I get that, and I listen to it about 20 times now. I'm going, holy shit. He manages to be very alternative. He manages to be out there, and every joke is just really great, and I can smell the work that's gone into each bit.
Yeah.
And then that, all I take from that is when I go back to my set, I think, I got to work harder at that. I got to write that better. You know, instead of taking it all like, yeah, just wing it, man, like that, I'm losing that attitude. Because that's a frightened attitude. That's scared of committing. Because if you commit to something and put everything in it and people don't like it, then you failed. So that was where that bullshit comes from. So now I just think, no, I'm great. Like, I'm slowly building up this confidence where I can actually say to myself, I think you're really good. So why don't you, you know, do them a favor and show them that
and
you're good.
And give your audience a show that you've worked on really hard.
Yeah, and I remember my 2012 show was a great show because I worked my arse off on it and didn't think I was, like, just winging it.
Now, which was 2012? Was that the award?
That was a nominated one,
The nominated one.
And then the 2010 and 11, where no one knew me, were also very good. I was sober because we were trying to get pregnant, and then we were pregnant the first couple of years of the kids, but it was a different kind of sober. It wasn't me having a realization and a complete change of character. It was more like white knuckling it and not for the sake of... And then it slowly came in. 2013 was a good show because I still had some momentum. And then all of a sudden, you know, anyway, I don't want to go into that too much because it's boring and I'm, and you can't really get into the levels of it. But I think what I was talking about, what was it? So that show, but even that show, I look back now and think, nah, I could have put more into that. And so I've got this show coming up. I'm doing Leicester Square Theatre and I'm sort of scrambling around, not panic, but in an excited way going, oh, I got to make that better. I got to tie that into that. I'm really buzzing on sobriety. Who knew? Like, it's so, after the last year got over the insecurity and the kind of terror and the really not knowing how to be, because I was under the influence on and off, but mostly on for 30 years. So it's quite a fundamental change.
This is something you said to me when we spoke at that Soho gig. You said that you'd realized that for 30 years you had basically been on something the entire time and you've got incredibly good at hiding it. Can we talk about that?
Sure. Yeah.
So when did that start and what did it start with?
15. Just thought I was having fun. So everyone goes, oh, there must be a reason. There must be an underlying reason. No, it was the thing that became the thing. So it was self-perpetuating. So I started just because I thought I was having fun. And I think probably down to growing up in the middle of nowhere on a farm and not having a lot of confidence in crowds or things like that. Probably low self-esteem. I don't know.
Boredom. Boredom's a lot.
And boredom.
I mean,
also just thinking it was cool.
I remember being 15 and feeling like experimentation with drugs would give me access to a sort of different world.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. And I remember, taking a shed load of mushrooms, like for about 3 years between, say, 16 and 19, nearly every weekend, take magic mushrooms. That really defined a lot of how I thought about the... And it was great fun the first couple of years when we were in high school and the future was bright. But then, you know, no future, like no university in the horizon. And then it became sort of darker.
Who's we? Time. Was it the
Me
same,
and my buddies,
same crowd of people?
My girlfriend at the time. And I think she's gone on to be a psychiatrist. And my buddies back in Canada. So it started off as, you know, pretty... All of it sort of slowly destroyed myself. And then I got really good at it. Like, I had the tolerance of, like, unbelievable tolerance where people just wouldn't have a... Like, it would be astounding the amount I'd get through. Because I had this terrifying... I didn't want to ever let people down or disappoint. So anytime people had ever seen me where I was letting them down, sloppy or late or missing something or not being very good, those were devastating. And then the only way over that would be to drink. But so I didn't want that to happen. So it wasn't like your classic, like, I think the cliche kind of, oh, you just all of a sudden got messy. It was a battle the whole time. And it was the effort it took that's what I'm like. I have so much time in my hands now. The effort of concealing when you're going to drink, how, okay, where you're going to get it, how you're going to conceal it, and then not really ever being confident. Because you just know this kind of secret about yourself.
Yeah. So you could always be found out.
Yeah. And thank God for my wife. She tried everything. She knew how to. But anyway, so what I'm enjoying now is just how much easier everything is. I realized that I was using it a lot because I had stage fright. And I never really ever had to get over that. And over the last year, I still not quite reached a peak of feeling super confident on stage, but I have been learning about it, and I definitely have had stage fright, and it's frightened me, but I can feel it growing. And now I reached these only four times in Edinburgh run where I reached Nirvana, where I got so relaxed, so it was as close as my humor I reveal to my loved ones or throughout my life when I've been in my funniest on stage. It was as close as I've ever got to that. And it was only about four times in the shows where people were crying with laughter. And it was like, I couldn't really, it was the same material, but there was a way I was doing it and there was a connection I was making. So that's my goal, is to get to that level every single time I'm on. Instead of for 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, and the rest of it being pretty good. I want it to be like just a unbelievable feeling when people are actually losing their shit. And none of us really know what's going on or why. It's that funny because the material's not that strong. It's more like just the audacity of things and stuff.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to that, the audacity. I remember from the Soho gig, you did a lot, and I'm afraid I didn't see your show in Edinburgh this year. But I remember one of the bits you were playing with was you're talking about doing a lot of therapy, and they don't like it when you keep bringing up World War II.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? I definitely want to get into that kind of.
Yeah, like, you're hiding from something, Mr. Law. No way, man. World War II was awful. That's one of the things that helps you get over stuff too, though, isn't it? And so you just read an Anthony Beaver. Berlin and just that, like the absolute slaughter and the terror of when the Red Army was going to Berlin. That makes you just go, well, yeah, things are all right, actually. Yeah. You know.
Okay, before we get onto that stuff and we'll get onto the material, I just want to get a sense of if you were kind of drinking or doing drugs the whole time, like on stage as well, did you ever work sober looking back in, like, say, the first 10 years of your career?
No, only when 2010, 11, 12, and a little bit of 13.
So
then after that, it was managing. Yeah, once the booze started, I did. I don't want to say it because I've got kids at school, but anyway, I did some narcotics, but not because of, like, out of a party as a way to manage the drinking. I found a way to make myself sober up, and it was magical, but horrific, of course. And then I always thought I was bulletproof, but of course you do. You tell yourself all these things.
And particularly you who, like, to use the example of Sean Locke, I can't imagine someone who does crafted one-liners over and over again could kind of get away with the sorts of abuse of your body and mind
that
someone who does your act away with.
That act was subconsciously created to create a way to always get my evil sauce. Like, so everything was, you know, even being a comedian in the first place is probably some sort of way.
Bit of a coping mechanism, like, can work when you want and get driven to gigs.
Yeah, I'm just having, and to other people, I'm just having a couple of pints before I go on. I had an agent who said, well, Stuart Lee only has a couple of pints before he goes on. Yeah, no, Stuart Lee does exactly that, perhaps. But that's what I've shown you. Yeah. You haven't seen yada, yada, yada. But, yeah, and then I guess my comedy persona has just been formed by that. So now that I've been normal for first time since I'd say when I was 17. I didn't really do mushrooms until I said 16, didn't I? But I just do remember being, I was really, really funny at school. And at 17, really funny. Not needy funny, just funny, funny, and inclusive funny. I was really... it's all been a journey to get that back.
Yeah. And that's really refreshing to hear. I've got a grown a pet theory over time that comics are often the second funniest person in their class.
I was number one.
You were number one.
and my friends were funny as fuck. Absolutely. Really funny guys. All of them. But I was funnier. And I was just driven to be funnier. Just always thinking of stuff to get laughs. Like, I remember driving into town to meet everyone to go out to a bush party or a football game. Just thinking of stuff about how it's going to make them laugh and getting really excited. Just, it's such a, and it must have been, you know, my parents, I can remember them. I have flashes of when I was little, getting them to laugh. I remember my dad one time, he was going to get the belt, to give me the belt on the arse. And I said, no, Dad, I'll get it. And I was like 4 or 5. I don't know if they planted this memory because they say this story a lot. I ran upstairs and got his belt and started whipping myself. He wasn't really going to do it. He was joking.
Okay.
Apparently. I don't want to delve too deep.
Yeah. I mean.
Until he passes on.
Okay. We'll do Tony Law Returns again in future.
And then, I went from like school. I really thrived because like I wasn't doing the work. But I was sure getting by on just charm and getting laughs from teachers. And it meant as much to... And I remember our school, like in high school, there used to be like bullies and jocks and all that in the years above us. But my gang of friends, half of them were music nerds and just cool sort of alternative guys. And then me and Darren were really good at sports, but super funny. So we were very inclusive. Our whole high school was the opposite of... Like, we were all nerds together, and that's probably where the experimentation with mushrooms came in, because it just allowed a more sustained amount of laughing. Just like we really needed to laugh, always needed to laugh and get laughs, and my parents always used to laugh at me as a kid, so it's really, like, sunk in there.
Now you're a parent yourself, do you have a different perspective on that?
Yeah, I try and be very careful of what I laugh at them about.
Yeah.
And my daughter is very, very funny, but she doesn't do it for her self-esteem. She's doing it because she's not doing it to please just generally. Like, she won't do it to strangers or she won't do it to people who are guests, but she will do it to people she loves. So she's got a very mature hit and run. Yeah, I recognize that. And the boy, he used to just try and get laughs, and now he's not as much. They're sort of above it. I look at them as being more mature. I quite like that. So I don't ever laugh at anything naughty. But I do laugh when they say something about Donald Trump, you know, like how horrible he is, but from a really surreal perspective. I do laugh at that because he just can't help it. I can't believe, because we leave Radio 4 on all the time. Unbelievable how much they soak up of Radio 4.
Okay.
And they know, like, what's going on, and they know series. Like, we don't even talk about it, because it's, you turn it down, and it's quiet in the background, you're doing your thing, and that's surprising. I wish I could remember some right now, but in the car, just some, and audio books. I didn't realize that, I thought they were watching, so, Mummy put a thing in the back for them to watch. One of their videos, and they're watching one of their videos, and I thought, and I'm listening to my audiobook, Richard Harris, Dictator, which is about Cicero and all of that business. Yeah. And my daughter asking at the end of a journey, like, Daddy, Cicero's friend, he has the same name as Atticus, doesn't he? He's Atticus. What was his last name? Like, what? Oh, I was just charmed. I remember taking them to, you were talking earlier about like thinking that like something will expand your mind, like growing up on a farm and all that, and not an academic family, you know, farmers, and knowing I was never going to be a farmer because I was just a failure at that. But I remember listening to Mozart. I got into it and I thought, if I listen to Mozart all the time, and I got all the Mozart on cassettes, this will open up culture and I will then be motivated to go to university and I'll find funding. And all it did though was meant that I now and throughout my life can recognize Mozart anywhere. I know all of it. Couldn't tell you what all of it's called, but I know it.
Okay.
That's all it's done. It was very self-contained.
Okay.
So there was something I was trying to lead on to. Oh, yeah. So with the kids,
exposing
I was thinking...
kids to a culture.
Yeah, I would take them to the British Museum ever since they were infants. I remember them laughing at the friezes, the Assyrian friezes. And they just thought that was hilarious because they're cartoons, aren't they?
Yeah.
Very two-dimensional. Obviously two-dimensional. And for a while I thought, oh, no, they're not soaking this up. They're not showing interest in history and all that. But it does come out in the things they bring back from school.
So this is Tony, really pleased that he decided to come back on the show, and we were meaning to make that happen for some time. I hope you managed to catch him at Leicester Square Theatre. And if you haven't seen him before, Tony is one of those ones for whom you can't just go, oh, he's a comedian. Like with a lot of acts that come on this show, even if you don't know their work, you can go, okay, they sound like that kind of act. If you haven't seen Tony live or in recorded media before, if you haven't seen the sorts of things that he's capable of, the sorts of risks that he takes, the kind of rhythm that he employs, the kind of approach, his whole approach to comedy is just so outside of the sphere of what you would normally see in a stand-up club. You absolutely have to see it. Now, two really important things, and then we'll bash on with the second half of the Tony Law interview. One is that Redacted is happening. You know about Redacted. It's the experimental late show time of 10:30 p.m. It's a ComCom-styled chat show that I am hosting. It's at the New Angel Comedy Club, which I believe is now... the name of that pub has been changed to The Bill Murray, which is rather sweet. It's at 39 Queenshead Street, London, N18NQ. I'm not advertising it anywhere. It's just for you and for the Facebook group. And I think we're going to try doing it. It's not going to be recorded, but we are going to try doing a Facebook Live video section of it. So I'll tell you more about that if you join the Facebook group. But Thursday, the 15th of December at 10:30 p.m, come along and see that. Please do come. I'm not advertising it anywhere else. Something I am advertising elsewhere is Hell Week. No, it's not a week. It's only 3 days because I've got a baby and I can't spare the time. But the plan was, a la Ronnie Cheng, to write all day, do a show, take notes from the show, write all day, do the show again, take notes from the show, and do that for an entire week. I've got 3 days of it together, but I'm still calling it Hell Week because I like the name. That is also at the New Angel Comedy Club at the Bill Murray, 39 Queenshead Street, blah blah blah. And that is on the 20-somethingth, why isn't it in front of me, of November. The 20... I'm going to Japan, man. No wonder I'm all over the place. How exciting is that? The 27th. I knew it was the 27th. That's a Sunday, the 27th of November. Also Monday, the 28th, and Tuesday, the 29th. But get on my Stuart Goldsmith Comedian fan page for details about that, because I tell you why... I consider that I've booked all three of those nights at 7 p.m. I check the Angel website and I'm not sure it totally agrees. So in the interim, check on my Facebook page first and on my or comedianscomedian.com. I'll put some blurb on there as well. That is going to be me crunching together the new show, because if I can bloody make this work, if I can go, right, there we are. You write really hard for a week, do the show every night for a week, fail again, fail better, then this could revolutionise the way I'm doing it. And I'll tell you more about this in the waffle, but I've written some of the stuff already, and it's been working, and I think it's because I took 2 months off after Edinburgh, 2 months off writing, and so I had loads more ideas, and now I'm like, I'm really enjoying writing this show in a way that I never have before. So it's an experimental concept, except I've slightly cheated and some of the stuff is already quite good. How's that? It's all free anyway, and you can book for a fiver online at Angel Comedy, but I'll give you all the links if you go to the Facebook page or the website. So that's all of that. It was quite chatty, wasn't it? But I think it's worth it. Let's get back to the brilliant Tony Law.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So before we move on from the the soupy past, I just want to get a sense of whether this is like you are completely cleaned up for good now,
yeah,
and how confident you are in that. Because presumably in the past, was it, have there been cyclical kind of times? Have you kind of done that binge and purge thing that, that—
No, I never, that was more lightweight kind of, no, I stopped twice. Once, before I met my wife, she met me sober. I talk about selling someone one thing and then, right.
Yeah, okay.
I was 2 years then.
Why did you stop that time? What was the trigger point for you going, this is too much?
Just because the whole time I was drinking up till that point, I just knew I hated it. Really hated it. You put it, and you pretend you're having fun and all. I couldn't figure out a way of being confident enough without it. And I loathed that feeling of not being on the same playing field as people, just in life, like not enjoying this coffee as much as some other people are. You know, like, I couldn't bear it. And I would talk to myself about it all the time. And I thought, well, I'm never going to meet anyone wonderful, and I'm never going to, you know, be my best self if I don't. And then I was in a van with Simon Munnery on the way to a gig, and Simon Munnery said, "You don't look very well, Tone." And I thought, well, there's a good cue. If Simon Munnery thinks you don't look well, I really respect him and love him. So that was my cue. And then I did pretty good, but it was a different kind of getting sober. It was a kind of a will. So it wasn't making any changes. It was always thinking about booze and, oh, I'm strong, I won't have booze. But it was always following me around.
Yes, it was like deciding not to have something just, you wanted.
Yeah, like showing I'm strong and look at my willpower. Yeah. But I still wanted it. And then it's—
and did you have a sense at that point of like the young, hilarious kid that you've described, the funniest one of all your friends?
Yeah, he started
how
to come back.
How did he kind of end up—
he came back
looking
and he
at
never,
himself going, oh, I'm really unhappy with the amount I'm drinking. That's quite a weird
he
kind
of— he sort of came back, yeah. He came back because he was always putting on a good show, though, when he was in that, the window of drinking. So he was still being— I developed this whole way of fooling myself and people around me, that saying, look how much fun I am. And the more fun I am, the more people would just ignore it.
Do you think, looking back now, you were fooling people around you?
Or not my wife.
Well, you know, other comics say, or, you know, bookers.
I think some people who don't really care because you don't see them that much.
Sure.
But I think there was an overall sense of can't really trust him. Can't really, you know, like, also there was lots of people who just really loved me and liked me as a person and thought I had untapped talent. And then just thought, well, no, you know, he doesn't have the trustness, like nothing officially or you just sense it on people. But then I started drinking
sense,
again.
You sense what on people? That they believed in you, but they didn't trust you enough to—
Or people felt let down, I think, maybe, you know, and, when I slowly started letting booze back in, it was because of the excuse was is I would tell myself, A, I could handle it, and then B, my career is not working out the way I wanted, and I always find an excuse. And then for the kids, because we wanted to get pregnant and then we wanted to have kids, that was easy to just go for a higher good.
Yeah.
And then,
but again, it was like it was a higher good based on you denying yourself something you actually did want.
Yes. And weirdly, the gig started going really— that's when I developed getting a following, you know, and I didn't really give myself enough credit for, oh, yeah, you're really good, actually, when you're like that. You're much better. You know, because I'd still say, yeah, but when I'm drunk, I can riff better. And my wife says, no, that's absolutely bullshit. You couldn't, you would repeat yourself. And even when you, but this, so I wanted to jump through to the difference between it this time is mental illness came along with it this time. And that's what really terrified me. And there's nothing that can, that changes your, you know, like some people get a health scare.
Mm-hmm.
And I physically, I just thought I'm absolute like a tank. It's just not. Didn't have any liver issues, no gout. Actually, I had gout once when I was 21 and I lived in Austria. That was too much Jägermeister in the morning.
Oh.
That was a culture where we just drank all the time. And I was really good at that. Anyways, there's going to be a great book when I
If you can remember it, can you remember all the...
I can remember lots and lots of things.
I was going to... I was about to say, this is telling, I was about to say, can you remember all the... And I was going to say adventures, as if there is somehow something heroic about drinking Jägermeister in the morning.
Yeah, no, it's all...
It's easy to convince yourself, isn't it, that it's like, this is a fun
life.
Can
you remember all that? Yeah, I can, but I'm not ready to go back on all that stuff, too, because I get sad, you know, at the... It's I get really sad, not only the... family personal stuff, that's you know, obvious and another thing, but no, also the waste of talent and waste of years, you know,
years spent performing thinking you were riffing really well on booms,
and wasting and- what and it's not not being anywhere near my potential apart from that window back then, and now I don't think I'm quite there yet, but I'm getting there and I can see it, and I don't want to waste any time, but it was the psychosis and the paranoia, you know, and all the mental stuff that came with the final year and a half before I stopped, and also the being able to even in that state see the damage I was doing to people around me, the disappointment and the... And then seeing these children and this wife and seeing, you know, finally going, oh, my God, I'm really lucky. It was basically beating back all the lies. And then that was one thing. And then you say, I'm never going to drink again. But then came the next bit, which is probably the harder bit, which is the building yourself up bit and going, oh, right, I'm not I don't know who I am. And then it slowly comes up and you get to decide, you know, you get to say, well, I think I get off on being kind, so make sure I do 4 kind things that day for people, just tiny things, and not taking that for granted, making sure I do. And then I go, oh, phew, I feel pretty good tonight, I can have a good sleep, I'm gonna do something nice tomorrow, make sure I do something nice here and there, and then slowly fixing it, and then that really translates in comedy. But the stage fright keeps creeping in, though, right? I never show it. It looks like I'm relaxed, but it manifests itself in slowing down.
Well, like when you're scared, you slow down, or when you're not scared, you slow
down. Yeah, slowing down or is one way, and then the other way is talking too fast and showing insecurity, which my character's kind of a high status. He comes across as dumb and crazy.
But he's a leader.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like breaking character. So
can you be specific about that? When you slow down, it's because of stage fright and that doesn't suit your character. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Or speed up too much.
Yeah.
And when I can relax and slow down, but in the different way of slowing down where for dramatic purposes... So I think probably I created that slowing down as if I'm about to do something thoughtful and take it a different direction. It's a bit elliptical, isn't it?
Whenever anyone comes on this show and talks in detail about psychological problems, like Seymour Mace came on the show and talked in depth about his depression and how hard it is to keep going under those terms. And I get this... I suppose some people are more candid about it than others. And whenever anyone talks in detail about it, I get loads of emails, and I'm sure that person gets loads of emails and contact from other people going, thank you.
Oh, really?
Thanks for talking about this.
Because
we see, particularly someone like you, who I think your fans within comedy, people who've seen you do comedy, just love you. Yeah, you might divide the room. There may be some people that don't get it sometimes, you know, but that just makes the people who are getting it love you.
Yeah, I feel intimidated by that, you know, like I remember why it's not the reason, but I remember feeling after 2011-12 things started to really snowball and going really well. I felt really awkward when it was starting to go really well. I just didn't feel like I deserved it, or like I just felt overwhelmed when people would be like, oh, I just think, oh, like I'd been selling them a lie or something. I don't know.
Go on,
it intimidated me. I didn't feel deserving. I know that sounds so so self-indulgent, which I am. I'm a very selfish person.
This is the place for self-indulgence.
But I used to not feel worthy of success. And then, but...
That's really interesting. Most people who've been going a long time through different iterations of their persona or in the way that you have that big change from the kind of, you know, Americana trouser turn
That
the different Tonys that we've seen.
Yeah.
I would think that most people who, when it seems like it's finally starting to work, it's gathering momentum, most people would think, finally, I've deserved this the whole time.
Yeah, and there was a sense of that at first. And I could feel it all coming. You know, you can just feel it. And it was bubbling. And then it scared me. You know?
What was scary about it?
I don't know. It's like you can't really put your finger on it. Genuinely. Just sort of a bit like...
Like suddenly you've got something to lose now?
There it is. Yeah, it's all about that. It's fear of loss. Which is weird. I've never really... I lost my best friend when I was 11. But I mean... That's nothing.
I mean, this is...
You're only 11. You don't know nothing.
If this was real psychology as opposed to armchair psychology, I would be making a real note. Because I think if someone goes, oh, I've had all these problems with alcoholism and all sorts of stuff, I've no idea why it is. I mean, obviously I lost my best friend when I was 11, but it can't have been that. You go, okay.
No. Don't be a... You know, I don't want to be a whiner.
What?
And then
how would that make you a whiner
if you suffered
an emotional tragedy?
My dad was very distant.
Yeah, that's a valid thing. Yeah, people's dads are often very distant, it affects them.
Yeah, sure. It's all that. All that. And just and also probably a chip on the shoulder coming from a farm and all that. Bit chippy.
I don't know many people from farms. What's the chip you're talking about?
You always have chip with townies. And then your small town has a chip with the bigger towns. And then you have a chip with someone from the city. But when you move to London, you can like, I'm in London now. You, man. There's an element to that, probably. Always feeling like you're from a middle of nowhere and that's where you belong, kind of.
Okay.
But this time I know absolutely because of a realization and also just a terror of, wow, this is the only life. This is the only crack at it. No more wasting time. So that I know for without question... I hate the thought of booze. I can't even think about it, which is, I just wish that had happened a lot sooner. It's so visceral and real. And my wife can tell. That's when I know she just reads me.
You talked a lot about your wife on the last episode. She was in the audience.
Yeah.
And you talked a lot about the ways in which she would challenge you creatively, that you made this commitment together to changing your process. You went, right, I've got kids now. I've got to knuckle down.
Yeah.
And you talked a lot about how you gave a really... Well, by the time we got into the second half of the interview where we kind of penetrated through some of the some of the bubbly stuff... we were talking, I thought it was really interesting. We were talking about how you gave this example of you'd meet in a cafe and go, right, we're working now.
Yeah.
And you'd say, okay, the show begins with space. And she'd go, why? And you'd say, well, because it's fear of loss. And she'd say, loss of what? And you go, children, my family. Do you know what I mean? And she was challenging you to...
Yeah.
To, and I thought that was really interesting that you would...
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I just thought it was interesting that you were being challenged to come up with almost the meaning behind the madness.
Yeah, exactly. And then she stopped coming to any shows or having any involvement around end of 13, 14, 15, because she said, and politely, I'm just cutting it down, but basically it was that she found it some bits too sherry. Some bits not enough work gone into it. Some bits too needy. Other bits just nothing behind it. She just couldn't bear to see it. So she stopped going and helping me.
How did that feel?
I didn't really notice. I just just blamed it on her. Lame, you know. It's only since... And so I was doing those shows on my own. It's only since the last... And this last... Since I've been sober, a year and 2 months or whatever... I now use what she did with me on my own because I'm not I'm much more in control now, or I'm a bit of a tyrant. So I wouldn't, I use those tools already, and she's busy doing everything she's doing, parenting and all the important stuff with kids that need a lot, you know, and I just feel more like a man, like confident that I can do my, and I'll go to her if, what do you think of this? Do you think, say you were a painter and that was a painting. What is it? What does that mean? And then, but I go to her from a position of, confidence and normal guy-ness rather than help me along. Yeah.
Do you feel when you're saying a position of guy-ness, so that sort of has echoes of what you said earlier on about like needing to show your children that you're a man, that you're a functional, a kind of a role model that you can protect them, you can look after, you need to show them that, probably in a way that you don't need to show a toddler that so much because a toddler just gets on with it. Yeah. By the time
you're already showing it by changing nappies. And
I was very
proud. I used to had such a sense of purpose. My wife's always told me that she really like the sexiest I've ever been was the first year and a half of them being babies because I used to pride myself on changing both of their nappies at the same time. Like I would really just like speed in it and then really get the cream on right. And I just used to take such pride. Yeah. So, so now I feel like that again, but more, somehow. I forgot what I was saying.
And I was talking about the difference in, or I'm just kind of picking up on this idea of wanting to be a man and show them that you are a protector, show them that you're on the case, show them you can, you can do it.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually believe in I can. I don't feel the need to hide anymore, you know, behind excuses and, I don't know if I doing it right, my stuff, nobody gets it. Or, you know, I never allow any of that anymore. If a gig goes bad, I first of all work out what I've done wrong and then work out how I can fix that. And then just confident enough to go, I'm not as bad as a bad gig.
Yep.
Whereas before, that used to just crush me. A bad gig would just finish me off. And then I'd drink my way out of it and I'd be all right again. But now I don't even feel that. I could go and do a gig in a terrible environment that's not right. And instead of complaining about it or worrying about it, just do it. Do it the best I can. And thinking, if anyone can pull this pointless gig in the middle of a foyer, it's me. And then I'll give it a go. And when, with that sort of honesty, you sometimes can. And you just go, oh, freaking hell, that was great. Good work. Or if it goes terrible and you get someone going, whatever, afterwards, it's, well, they don't know. That's all they've had to go on. So, you know, they don't know that I have a following of people who think I'm really clever. and how would they know? So, you know, a bit like if someone would have been rude to me in the queue of something before, I'd make a big deal out of it. And now I'd rather, they're having a bad day. Who knows? Yeah. And that's such a great way to go, to carry on as a, you know, not waste time. I'm into not wasting time.
And do you still... Or do you feel any kind of remnants of that feeling of I don't deserve this success?
No. Now it's completely switched. Whereas I think no, I really messed it up. What an idiot! I could have had some money now. So it's more of a panic and anger at my old self, not anyone else but myself. Just thinking, you dick. So I'm.
It's do you feel then that you, when you got the, when it all started to happen, I was going to say the nomination or the award? Did you win the award?
I won some chortles.
Fine. But you were nominated for big.
I should have been back every year for 4 years in a row getting nominated instead of letting it slip. I'm angry at myself because that's your leg in. As soon as you get a nomination, it's your foot in. They're always going to keep an eye on you then. But you let that go.
Do you feel you let it go? It's interesting because I didn't see your last show, but I kind of I was like, oh, Tony's away. I think that's the feeling on the circuit. I think that I felt that was still the feeling on the circuit. Like Tony's going for it. It's going off.
I was still going, but the shows were. I don't know. It's kind of nebulous. It's like, it's just like a feeling. So for me, I was still doing the shows and people were finding something in it, but I wasn't brilliant. I was doing pretty good.
It's like you get the nomination. Now is the time to open up the throttle and be brilliant.
Yeah, really. And I wasn't as good. I mean, I was doing some big shows at like the Utterbelly Cow on the river. And I was still getting, you know, I was still being shit hot some gigs. And that's what's maintained a following, I think. But I was also not being as shit hot every single time.
You kind of, I feel like there was a sort of a nail varnish scarf period where you kind of went, oh, I'm weird, am I? I'm going to be really weird then.
And but it was the wrong kind of weirdness, because my real weirdness is actually wearing a flight suit or something. Or it's not even weird. It's just I like wearing things that 15-year-old children are into.
Or a gauntlet.
Yeah. Those are the things I like, rather than fashion-y.
So was that kind of fashion-y weirdness, was that kind of an attempt to protect yourself? Because you were like, well, if I'm really weird, then no one can judge me.
It was a mixture of all these things. But, I mean, part of a genuine wanting to have a look and finding it interesting that to add some layers to my stand-up.
I tried to talk to you about this before in the previous interview that we did. I don't know that I kind of quite got to what I wanted, which was, I think it's very brave is the wrong word, but I think it must have been a challenge to go from, like, you've had styles. I always think whenever, because I don't have a style, I'm literally a guy in literally jeans and a t-shirt. And that's important to me, because I believe, no, I'm just one of the people in the room. It's just I'm standing up at the moment, you know? And I talked to Tim Minchin recently, and he was talking about his kind of a really overt, almost calculated look, which, bang, you get them, and then later on you can let them into the fact that you're just one of them,
same
as everyone else. And I'm like,
no,
shit, I wish I'd thought of that. But it is courageous, artistically, I think, to go from, I look like this, and I am now going to look different.
Yeah.
And all the people who saw me before, surely, I'd be thinking,
I was trying to be David Bowie in my own little way.
Yeah, okay. Was there an element of fear of kind of going, some people will know that I've kind of thrown this together, because they remember what I looked like before?
No, not at all, because that I put thought into that look too. So the 50s quiff thing, that was all calculated. All of it's been calculated to be memorable. And also, I really, especially when I was, I like to, if you get a new costume, it usually generates material you never would have thought of doing.
Yeah.
So it created a real interest in Vikings and pirates in me back for a couple of years, because that's what I was getting from people. So I really learned a lot about Vikings and pirates.
Just just to stay with that subject for a second, getting material, like starting points for material. What other sorts of ways do you generate starting points?
Well, nowadays it's completely different than the old days. In the old days, it was just see what happens, and I didn't really. But now, actually, a little bit of it then, but mainly now it's reading into whatever I'm interested in, and then going down rabbit holes on Wikipedia. Because I love history still. That's always been my constant. Isn't it interesting, though? I have less interest in football since I've been sober, which I used to think I really liked it. And I wonder, it just feels such a waste of time and so limiting.
Oh, this sport that I get together and drink with other people when I watch.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't so exciting after.
I learned how to do good London accents from those years.
Okay.
History. So, just getting into something like that and then just going for it. But also, I'm doing loads of different things now. I'm listening to DVDs of people I find in petrol stations, always petrol stations, to just open my mind up, or get a audio book of something I'd never, like, I buy all the recommended things from the Old Woman's Hours, and I just try. Lavender and
that's a great idea for a radio pitch. Is Old Woman's Hour?
the old ones from a while ago. And then because I drive so much now, and that's where I get a lot of kind of therapy. And my dog is a huge, huge dog who needs, he's so big and powerful and wonderful that he deserves a lot of effort. Like he deserves 2.5 hours in the park every day because he's an athlete. A cuddly one, but
2.5 hours in the park a day. Yeah. I don't know about dogs. That sounds
a lot. He's a big German Shepherd. I got him. He was the best bad decision. He was my last bad decision. I need a dog, and all of a sudden, oh God, yeah, there you are. And so he, so we drive a lot together, and we listen to Radio 4 pretty much 24 hours of the day. We just, it's definitely therapy. Both the walking, the driving, and the Radio 4 just need it. Every day, can't do a day without it. So hotel rooms, when you do gigs on tour, used to be just watch TV or not turn it on. Now I have to have Radio 4 on wherever I go. It's like a crutch. And I don't need to be listening to exactly what they're saying.
But it's reassuring.
Very just comfortable, comforting. And Wolfie likes it. I'm sure he loves it. I don't think he liked the...
Who named the dog?
Well, I did. Yeah, because I pretend that the kids did. Wolfie. Oh, yes. So he's an absolute world-class dog. And we've made him into the softest, cuddliest German Shepherd on earth. He's just such a nice boy. But you can make your dog. It's definitely a lot of nurture goes into their personalities. And I've been going to gigs early and watching other comedians, not going to big gigs where you pay 30 quid. I can't do that. I would to Sean Locke though. Unbelievable. He's really alternative. He's like all of us good guys out there. He is, but big.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah, I totally agree. Sean Locke is one of my favorite
so good
comedians.
And, that's inspiring. And then I go to the woods and I take pals to the woods. Like I took Lloyd Langford to the woods the other day and,
oh yeah.
And just walking, he goes, have you used that? Have you used that? Just from bantering, have you used that? So I got a few have you used that, so wrote it down. And I guess just simply being more alert and aware. And watching comedy to get a feel for what people are talking about. Dylan Moran had a good conversation with me about like what, you know, really respecting the audience more. Putting more thought into the audience, which I never really did enough. I actually think, what are my guys into? What's going on in their lives? Trying to learn. And that was Dylan Moran reminded me, you know, like, don't be selfish. Tell you, you know, you're a doctor. And, you know, you got a job. You got to point to your job. You got to, and all that stuff I never
really
considered.
How do you mean you're a doctor?
Well, he says, you know, to have respect for what you do. That's what, I never really thought about that.
And to feel less like you're getting away with something and more like,
yeah,
you're
more like
a professional
you've got something
guy.
People need. Yeah, they... that what you do, if someone decides they like you, you know, you kind of owe it to them to take it seriously and that sort of thing, rather than just kind of, oh, I'm just getting me.
Yeah. And it must be seductive though, because I think when you have spent such a long time going, you know, and kind of like sort of easing your way in and talking, you know, changing up the paradigm.
Oh, whatever happens, happens, man.
Exactly. And then you do get a certain amount of success from that.
Yeah.
That must be very seductive and very difficult to then go, nope, got to work.
Yeah, I don't know. Any success I got was due to working because it came from that period. And then I coasted on it or something and then got afraid. But yeah, and that was nice of Dylan. He was really kind. I've never met him before. He sought me out to speak to me. I thought that was like, wow. It's like
awesome.
He's like a legendary older brother who... we never met and he wanted to give me some guidance on the path. It was quite moving actually.
Yeah, it sounds
He said I was like Oblix. I fell into the potion. But he's much I do. I feel like I've betrayed him now, but I don't think that's such a bad thing to have betrayed someone over. It was just wonderful that he took the time or interest to just take me aside. It was like,
do you have, and you may not, this might be a total non-starter, but do you have the equivalent of that relationship in the other direction? Is there any, are there any kind of newer acts that you've done something similar to or for?
Lots. I think I'm pretty nice to lots. And I'm very fond of just in general, I like younger people anyway. So that's lucky. I don't know. Either very old people or very young people seem to be my... I'm very good friends with Luke Roberts because he's very different background from me. And yeah. I don't know, but yet our minds meet very neatly in the middle. So I enjoy him. I don't think that I give him any advice or anything. I think I take more. I think I'm more of a taker. I'd like to think one day I'd be able to poetically extol it. Is that the right word? Extol advice?
Extol.
Extol, yeah. That's to someone. I think it, who there must be more. I really like going to like gigs that's run by this sort of generation of people who've been abandoned by Brexit. You know, I feel like there's a lot of energy there, and you know what I mean? Well, my wife's grandfather, apparently he was like that as well. He had this, well, you know, young people, it's had more energy, more like he didn't like how people got conservative or that's definitely, I just like them.
Are you doing anything clever marketing wise?
Not yet, but I'm just starting. A student who's always been a fan has taken an interest, wants to help me. And I just also basically said very straightforward, you're wasting your whatever it is you're doing. You just, it's a waste and it's a shame. You should be capitalizing on this and this and this and this. And I'm going, brilliant. And I don't even have a laptop. I've got like a phone. So he's helping me. We went on a tour of the YouTube facilities today. And I've got just silly little short film ideas and make series of them. And so I'm learning how to do that. So it's all sort of beginning now. Everything is being reborn now. And I have this sense of, oh, I wish I could make it up to that person. You know, like somebody from some TV channel or something singing your praises. And then you kind of let them down maybe. I feel like going, hey, guys.
Yeah.
But not out of desperation, really free of any of that.
Will you have to work harder to win them back?
I think it's so. I think so.
I mean, especially if you did do that period of like sobriety before.
Yeah.
Did people give you chances there and then you...
Probably. Yeah. So that will be... I mean, that's the shame of it, isn't it? Of any addiction is that... It you carry that shit around with you. But I think people can tell the difference between a guy on a mission. You get, you know, because I think that sobriety at that phase was very different. I was still a needy kind of guy rather than... I think you can sort of sense the difference. And also, even at that time, I was still not reaching the levels of... that I needed to anyway. So yeah, definitely. I think that's the shame of it, but that's the way of all of those things, isn't it? It is that extra level. So it's like going into a job, like relaunching yourself, you know, look at how healthy I am. It's not like going into a job where it's fresh and you get to start with in the desk and everything. It's like taking over a job from the last guy who left a fucking mess. And he was really, you know, people loved him at the office, but he let a lot of people down.
And he had the same name as you, which
name,
is going to be very difficult.
He looked like me. And I mean, you can shave all you want, but people can see underneath that beard. That's why I shaved.
Really?
It's my new me. I didn't want people to always say, what happened to the beard? And I don't want to go, because I don't want to be that guy no more.
Yeah.
And I shaved it. And it's taken me a while to actually believe that this face is as funny. Because, I mean, the way my whiskers, I've got a really fat upper lip. And this is true. The whiskers used to shoot upwards into a smile. So my neutral face, even if I wasn't smiling, was smiling.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, I
absolutely
recognize
that. Makes a huge difference. Tiny things like that. There's so much in it.
I didn't even notice that you didn't have a beard anymore because in my mind, you're always Tony from the 50s period.
Yeah. Oh, you know what I mean? Yeah. You're from the first phase.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So nice. When you got into the Zephyr phase, you know, the Lord of the Wind, I was like, okay, that's Tony's thing. I'm not sure if I like it. It's when you like when your dad grows a beard and you're like, no, don't, that's not Tony.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah. Some people want the beard back. Daughter wants the beard back, but...
Yeah.
But daddy's not No. I just have to shave more often because otherwise you're too spiky for kisses.
So when you... That's true.
Yeah.
When you... I have a baby.
Yeah, I know. Congratulations.
I've got to be careful.
You got to shave her up.
Because otherwise...
Either you have a
I
big soft
him,
beard.
He gets all unhappy and I've hurt him.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You got to have a big soft beard or keep her shaved.
Yeah.
Oh, razors.
So when you say... When you said just then that you have had concern... I'm not exactly sure what words you used, but like you were worried that your face isn't as funny.
Yeah.
Like that's
like a genuine thing.
Yeah, that to me sounds like a sort of a general feeling of, hey, the guy I was before was pretty wild and anything could happen. And now you need to try and get that wildness and those brilliant moments without access to magic drinking.
Well, not so much that actually. No, because I don't. Look at him as being, it's different. The way I look at him now is a sad person who's pretending to be happy and having fun, and a weak person who was nowhere near his potential. Like, you know where I would get my potential, Anna, would be on Have I Got News For You or Buzzcocks, I remember, because I felt so relaxed and people accepted me and there was no preparation. So my fear of writing crisp stuff, which I don't have anymore, wasn't it. So I was free to
go.
Look
crisp
at all these people looking at me, and I'm in the middle of they're bringing me drinks, coffees, anything I want, and they're looking after me. I get a car home at the end of the night. Woohoo! It's the greatest time of my life. And even then, though, I look back and think, damn it, I would be 1,000 times better if I did that tomorrow, if I did Have I Got News For You, than I was maybe not sleeping for a few days.
Yeah.
But not being out partying, maybe the odd time find myself somewhere, but mainly kind of secretively just awake. Oh, anyway, it's so complex. And so I look back at him and I just think, oh, dude, no way, man. And I've put on a lot of weight now and I look back and I think, oh yeah, he was thin, but I'd rather be a fatty and a cool fatty. Like my brother's a bit fat, but he's also really... He's just a powerful presence. He's cool, and he'd do anything for his family, and he's just a rock. And I feel like I'm growing into that sort of person.
That's
like
nice.
A cool dude that my wife will find hot all the time, just from doing the right thing by your son, or just being the right, doing good parenting. Really feeds into, fixing a problem or listening to one of their problems the right way can really lift your self-esteem.
Do you have a different way of, like, I would imagine that old Tony had a certain toolkit of getting them on board when they're not going for it. Those kind of like comedy, you know, the things in your toolkit where you're like, oh shit, they didn't go for that last bit. Oh, I'm going to pull them back somehow.
Yeah.
Do you find whatever that toolkit was that you have a different one now?
Yeah, because the toolkit was getting empty. Now it's more... No, I don't have that toolkit yet, anymore. So I don't think. It's similar, like shouting. But back then, you see, I would rely on a bit that I knew was short and concise from another show. The elephant's bit. I'd always pull that out. But that's
your idea of a short and concise bit.
Yeah.
Elephant's bit.
But now I can't remember anything old. It's like I'm really on year zero or year one. I mean, this is like AD1 or so I can't really go into the old stuff. Like I can go back over the notebooks and I go, oh, damn it. I've only left a sentence for a whole bit.
You can't remember the bit.
No.
Do you want to? I mean, this podcast would be an easy way to crowdsource people emailing you bootleg.
Oh, no, please don't. No. I can't watch myself from those days. I'll watch anything from like last night or next week.
Yeah.
I'll watch any of that because I could say something dumb or make a mistake or do something that's not funny and it wouldn't bother me. I'd just go, oh, yeah, better fix that. Now I feel like I can go on. Like the other day, I thought, when I'm feeling really confident, I went and this is going to sound like such a prick, but I just wanted to see if I thought I was feeling funny, and I was funny around the house, and I was funny with my mother-in-law, and I just felt funny all the way to Old Rope. And I thought, if I'm feeling funny, I wonder if I just played Stack on my phone, I could get laughs. Because my bones felt funny, and I wonder if it came across. And I was getting laughs. I mean, they're really nice anyway.
Yeah.
But all I was doing was they were watching the concentration on stack. And if I was brave enough, I would have kept going.
Yeah.
And I got big laughs on that. So I haven't had the courage to do that again somewhere. But yeah, there is something about when you're feeling funny. It oozes out of your pores, doesn't it? And then, but what I need to work on is when you're not feeling super funny, how to still be, give people what they deserve. So finding a way to get in that space.
That's the magic.
And that's where booze used to help for a while. It could get you into a certain kind of jolly sometimes. Yeah. And now you just got to go. Drinking a lot of Diet Coke. I wonder if that's replacing anything. an ice cream. I should have knocked that on the head a little bit too. Craving sugar in the middle of the night.
Okay. Eating ice cream in your car. That was a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I did do that. Yeah. Yeah, that was me doing an actual bet from...
Yeah. That was like an observation about your life. Yeah, I do. Sharing my soul.
Yeah. And I don't feel resentment towards successful acts. I remember when I was drinking, I used to. I'd pretend I didn't, but I used to in my head. Just like, oh, God, I can't believe he did good. And I bought a Michael McIntyre CD because, from petrol stations. Brilliant. Very funny.
Yeah, he's a really good comedian.
He's really good. He's really good. And he's got great accents. And I feel like it's very similar to kind of what I do in a way. And I remember him when I remember the phase of him having to use coupons to survive. So, I think, oh, good for him. Good, hardworking example. Stuart Lee was a good example about filling your day with ideas and writing. I learned that from him. Also a little cynicism, maybe. I was always finding a way to not make the job important back then.
You were finding... I'm just going to think about that sentence. You were finding a way to not make the job important.
Yeah, does that make sense at all?
You mean in a way that you now think is negative, like you would find ways to not
work? To just like, I can do it, it's easy. Like not commit.
Yeah. Like telling yourself, no, it's better if I don't work, actually, because then it'll be more true.
Yeah, a little bit of that. Yeah. A little bit of that sometimes. Yeah. And, it's always better when you do the work. Even if it means waking up and you can't sleep. Even if that means just reading or not comedy, just reading something. That's work. Doing good parenting, like watching something educational, that's all work. And then you tell, then your confidence in what you do, it builds up. You think, yeah, no, that's work. It's work. Everything's work. Chit-chatting, work, everything should be work.
And what isn't work?
Watching football. I've sort of eliminated most of that stuff. I know. Trying to extract value from everything, so therefore treating everything as valuable, and then that sort of filters out. So everything you do and read and consume and your actions, you want them to be of value in some little way, and so you end up just doing those things now, or I do now. It's all like a whole quest to be a good dude. So it's rechanneling obsessions and stuff, isn't it, into a positive way.
Are you still doing the therapy?
No, not I felt like I had gone as far as I could with that one, but I'm gonna start some more soon because it's quite good fun.
I'd like it. Yeah. I sometimes feel like I'm ripping the guy off because I'm really enjoying myself.
Yeah, I have to stop myself from getting laughs. Like when I did group stuff at a recovery place, I didn't realize how angry I was because this is a serious thing in people's lives and I was trying to get laughs.
Yeah.
And I really upset people. Didn't know
shit.
It.
Sorry, my laugh was misplaced.
No.
I was envisaging a situation where you're killing it.
I was killing it, you know, but then it was slowly resentment built. So I regret that, but I learned so much from that. I learned about when not to do stuff. And, but so also, there's also not deserving it. You know, I was thinking, oh, I don't deserve it. There's people with way more problems. But my wife says, no, you need it. You deserve it. Like, that's enough for me to go, oh, all right, then. You need to work on that there. So I'll probably do some more of that. But I don't want to, you don't want to do too much self-help, you know? So, no, not.
I'd like the listener to know I nodded sagely at that point.
Yeah,
because I'm concerned that my silence could be taken as there's no such thing as too much self-help. No, yeah. I totally agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to do too much like up your own arseness, because then that would change fundamentally my act too on some level.
One of the exciting things about your act is how much of the world there is in it.
Yeah.
You know, Vikings and World War II and spiders and orca. And you know what I mean? There's a lot of, it's a very rich, if you were to draw your act, you could really fill a page. You know?
That's right. Yeah. I'm always hoping to keep it. I always see a blue background, light blue background, sky background, clouds. And then, filling it full of colors and stuff and forests and empires and maps. Love a map. But my dog is that's all I need for therapy. That oxytocin exchange. When you hug him, it's just like, oh, I am full. I hope you got as much from that hug as me. And then I don't know what it is. You know when you really sort of feel safe and happy and you think about your wife and you think about your kids, then the dog does something funny and you laugh, and it's really not that funny to anybody else. You know, like just he'll jump over a big tree, but he'll do it really fast with flair. And I'll be like, and you think, no, it wasn't funny. That's just joy. Ah, that's joy. That's what it is. That was a little bit of the old joy.
I was thinking of this recently, trying to articulate to my friend what it's like having a baby. Now that I'm out of the first couple of months that I found very difficult and harder than I'd anticipated, it really threw me off. And now there's so much joy.
Yeah.
And I found myself saying to my mate, I've just got this... You know, this feeling of like, what's the opposite of guilt?
Yeah.
And it's just the opposite of that. It's that I'm so used to the habit of walking around. I've talked about this in the waffly bit at the end of this show before. Getting into the habit of worrying about stuff, getting the habit of concern and over self-concern. And then just going, there's an opportunity here to get into the habit of being really filled with joy.
Yeah, and concern. Yeah, I love that feeling on the way, like... Now, I mean, in the old days, I would, because I wasn't driving, I'd get into a hotel and I'd just more isolation, more alone. Now I think I'll drive home and then give them back the hotel. Oh, you keep it. Don't worry. Or, well, if you got some petrol, you know, and then being giddy, going, can't wait to get the kids up in the morning. Just can't wait. Oh, my God. That all, you have to feel confident in yourself to get to that, I think. Rather than before, it wasn't that I didn't love my kids or want to be around, it's since I wasn't, you know, confident or worthy enough. If you're leather in it, you know, you always get worried if it's on your breath, yada yada. But now I just went, safely. You're an important person. You're important to people.
Yeah.
Slower down. Oh, audiobook. Oh, what are we going to have today? Oh, Mozart, Symphony number 25 in G minor. And I go from BBC 3 to 4 back and forth. That's my favorite. Anyways, I do go off track still. What was I talking about? Yeah, try and get the world in there for sure. Maps. I've got a little office now. It's in the sitting room, but I have a TV tray. Oh, my God, I love that. And I sit with my TV tray and I got my notepad and I got my keyboard that goes into an old iPad that is too full of stuff. And so only runs like a Word document thing. And I sit there and I look at my books and stuff and try and fill my head full of positive memories. And then see what wormhole. That's, aren't we lucky to live in a time where we can just go, oh, like you would have dreamt. Like I need to know what Glen Campbell was like in concert in 1973 singing Wichita Lineman. Do, 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 do. There it is. Oh my God. And then an hour later, you find yourself watching a Sammy Davis Jr. being roasted by Dean Martin on a 1979 TV. I just going, oh my God, they were funny then too. It's like living inside of history. We're so lucky, aren't we? This internet business. It's a hell of a thing.
I always remember about 10 years ago seeing Arj Barker saying at the Comedy Store, saying, don't quote me on this, but I think the internet's going to change the way we live.
Yeah. I remember a guy in a conversation after I worked in this pub, and a guy who was a friend of someone we always have drinks after, saying, talking about the internet. I remember that. I am so old. I don't feel bad about that. I'm really glad I am. You know, I've been to the Soviet Union. I'm an interesting guy. I was there when I was 17. And we went on a school trip. We saved and worked and worked and worked and worked and saved up our money. And we had the right amount of grades. And we went, and two of my nerdy slash cool dudes came with me. We went to Soviet frickin' Union, man. Anyways, what was it? There was some...
sitting down, painting the sky blue with your computer, then, filling all the things in your
something
head.
Something else. Sitting in my office with my TV tray.
Glen Campbell. We're so lucky to be living inside of history.
Yeah, that kind of thing. What did I do that was interesting apart from go to the Soviet Union? Oh, no. This is a block. I get these blocks. I hate it. And now I'm going to get obsessed on.
Well, tell me. It'll come.
Yeah, go.
It'll come back. Tell me the, just to wrap up. We must wrap up. But tell me the, what's the end of that idea of you sitting there, you're noodling around on Wikipedia, you're looking at stuff, filling your head up with stuff. What are you kind of tangibly writing? You've got a notebook there. Yeah. What's in your notebook? What does a page of that notebook look like? Are you writing starting points to then get on stage and improvise around?
I used to do that more. Now I'm coming up with fully formed ideas. That's new for me.
Okay. What's the... Give us an idea from that.
Bonobos. I was just stood at the back waiting to go on. And I just thought to myself, because I'm... newly fat. I talked about being newly fat. Yeah. And then I thought, I shouldn't be fat because I just lived for a year. And rather than tackle my recovery straight on, I lived with the bonobos for a year. And, but I forgot to take notes, something like that. and then that sort of growing into, and then I took my dog. I shouldn't have taken my dog because bonobos never seen a dog. And then he ate one and I love him. But then it goes into morality about, like, if you love someone and they do something like eat a bonobo, it's, it really calls into question, when does your love need to stop? And so it's kind of growing from that.
And are you, when you're writing those notes, are you editing as you go, or are you just going, let's just follow this and see where it
goes? Following it, yeah. But this last few months, starting to edit. So my Edinburgh show, yeah. Was really just, the thing that Storm used to do, my wife used to do in the good shows back when she was had faith, and she does again, but I'm the boss now. But she would say, why that? Do you need that? Why is that there? Really brave. But I do that to myself now. Like, but I also embrace subject matter. I used to think, I want to be original. Everything is, but there's nothing ever going to be truly, purely original, especially with this internet. You know, there's, everybody can know everything, everybody, you know. So if I have actually written in, not this notebook, another one, sink. I want to do something, just a whole list of, just do something about the sink, relationships, and I want to see what happens when I write stuff about that. You know, it doesn't have to be about your semi-professional career as a trampolinist in the 1970s. Although I do love doing that. And then trying to find ways to do fun accents. Ice cream, underpants, doing a bit about underpants. Stack, and always trying to find a way to do my airplane sounds.
Yep.
I do World War II airplane sounds all the time.
Can you give us one?
That was a hurricane going by about 100 meters away.
Enjoyed that immensely.
Yeah, yeah.
Finally then.
Okay.
If you had to review yourself now.
Yeah.
Like your latest show.
Yeah.
What would your review of it be?
I would give it a 4.5. So to me, it's a 5, and to a lot of fans, it'll be a 5. But I got to give it a 4 or a 4.5 because I think there's still some left in the tank, and you can't go to 6.
Make a mockery of the whole pointless system.
Yeah, exactly. But I'd say 4, but sometimes 5. Like when I get people crying with laughter, it's 5. I can't really judge art. But I'm better than I've been for a long time. But I've got to fix this obscurity thing. We're making too many routines that are just, you know, the reference points are just specific to me and 5 other people. You know, I got to work on that. But when I get laughs off of those bits, I think, yeah, that was pretty good.
When we last spoke, you talked about wanting to be mainstream. You talked about like the super comedy fans who go and see 25 shows a year.
Yeah.
They come and see you. You need to get the people who go and see one show a year.
Yeah, I'd like that. And I want to find a way to reach out to them and find them and get them to come along and see that, like what Sean Locke does. He's probably changed the comedy scene a hell of a lot more than most, I bet, because he's an audience has gone along and gone, wow, that was silly and clever and intricate and weird. Like he does surprise you on a main, you know, big stage at a big theater, and you're going, oh my God, well done. Harry Hill, too, he's pretty blown it up, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I'm going to buy a Ross Noble one now that I've seen one.
Oh, yeah. Ross sent me those as a kind of research before he came on the show. You could take one of those with you.
I don't have a DVD player.
Well, that
is it a CD? I could put.
Hey, it's their DVD, I'm afraid, yeah.
Yeah. This has been fun. Do I seem different from the last interview?
Yeah. Yeah, you do.
Do you think I'm better like this?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I think
well,
so.
Well, definitely. In every imagine respect.
Imagine if someone just...
No, I don't think so.
I think you're better when you drink.
Seems pretty sick. Oh, my
God. I used to have that fear at first. Nobody's going to think I'm any fun. And my wife and you were not fun at all, mostly.
Yeah, right.
But apart from little windows.
You're very lucky to have that kind of window into your...
Feeling sorry for yourself 90% of the time and then going, hello, stranger. Oh, I might entertain the waitress who has nothing to do with my family. I'm going to entertain the guy at the petrol station there.
One of the qualities that my partner has that I really value is she has got a really good memory. I've got almost no emotional memory. I can't remember how I was at any one time. Ah. So the first day of Edinburgh this year, just gone, like the second day, I was freaking out. The show wasn't ready.
Yeah.
I knew that it was problematic. I was up there with my baby for the first time. Oh. And I was going, oh my God, we were going to meet some friends. And I said, I can't meet these friends. I don't have time. I've got to pointlessly run around working on the show and freaking out. And she said, you remember you felt exactly this way on this day last year? And I went, I did not remember that. Is that right? She said, yes, you did. And she said, we were standing there. You had to go into a phone box and have a little cry because you were freaking out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I'm so glad you're here. You know?
Well, my wife was really worried about the different times I'd have mood swings. Pre-Edinburgh and then when we'd get to Edinburgh. And I remember there was a couple of times where I caught her looking over at me and you could see her mind was clicking through going, hey, he's not being an asshole. Is he? Like, I really have noticed watching her learn to trust me and learn to go, oh yeah, I like him. You know, like, you could see she'd panic and think, oh God, he's going to be grumpy or moody, or he's going to be emotionally distanced or cut off his love, withdraw his love, you know, like that typical feely sorry for the, and oh, he's not. I could see that. Oh my God. Yeah, but then hold back. Well, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to commit too much. Oh, look, he's done it again. He seems jolly all the time. I could see that happening. panics are much less for me. But a bit, they're still there, though. But having your panic in advance is the best way to do it, isn't it? Further in advance. That takes your empathy. Personal empathy? Empathize with yourself. So you can predict, I'm going to be terrified on day one at the festival. Oh, that's great that she told you.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you mean. Go, I see what you mean. Oh, that happens here, does it?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, I'll do that now. Dealt with that.
Will I be distant tonight?
Yeah.
That was me.
Yeah.
So
great.
Oh, yeah. This is great.
It's been great, Tony. Thanks. Man. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I'm really glad to see you being like this.
Yeah, thank you. You're a kind man. Sorry I called you a prick all those years ago.
That's okay.
So that was Tony. I'm so pleased to now have a record of Tony, of his practice, of how he works, of how he thinks, of where he's coming from and where he's going as part of the podcast. Because it always, I as soon as I found out that he was distressed about the first podcast appearance, because obviously at the time he was being very, very louche and seemed very happy with himself, as we often are when we are in our cups. I'm very pleased now that there is something of which I hope he can be proud. I'm really proud of that interview, and I think he is a superb comedian. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does next. Next up, I've still got Gethard. Shall I put Gethard out? Carmen Lynch. Oh, what a wonderful comic. Yes, maybe we'll have Carmen next week and Gethard the one after that. And then we've got Joe DeRosa. And then I've got to get some new episodes in. Who knows, man? So much comedians. That is all that. I will now conclude the show and talk to you about two potentially boring sounding things, so I won't even name them. I'll chat to you about them if you choose to stick around. But if not, thanks to Tony. Hashtag thanks, Daryl. info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to get in touch. And you can always put PS, I'm a cool guy, if you would like to let me off the hook and give you a one-word response that you know means that I have actually read and digested it. I'm just fucking busy. The show's going to be great, man. Come along to Hell Week. Come along to Redacted. And do check out nextupcomedy.com. That concludes the podcast. I've got to open. I wasn't going to do this, but I've just got to open quickly by telling you I'm just apologising for my blocked up nose again, man. Autumnal hay fever. It's just absolute bullshit. I'm just so allergy stricken, and I can hear myself and think, oh, all this wonderful legacy that I tell myself I'm creating by recording all these interviews, recording all the blurbs and the waffle and everything else. I can hear myself going, and in tone as well as content. And how frustrating is that? So, here's a thing that started off being dull and has actually made me sort of quite hopeful. I've been having a bit of a clear out. I've been having whatever the autumn equivalent of a spring clean is. And I'm going to clean all the pots and pans under the sink. And I've cleaned the wine rack. Just domestic stuff. Just the sort of domestic shit that I never used to get round to. Because I was always just zipping out and gigging and avoiding all of the domesticity of my life. And now I've been kind of rugby tackled to the floor. Very willingly. And kind of plugged into this new domestic existence where you've got to like change bed sheets and stuff. I mean, I did before, but it wasn't like in a house, in like a homemaking situation. And when you're a parent, you can't fuck about. I've started doing the washing up last thing at night before I go to bed, so that in the morning the kitchen is clean. Who am I? Who is this guy? But as soon as you get into that, you become Danish. My friend Dan Foreman he was one of those guys that as soon as he became a dad, it was like, ah, you make sense now. You've been a dad the whole time. And he's just one of those implacable washer-upper types. You know, I always thought it was because he did bar work. But, you know, someone like you're at a house party and someone's like, I'll get that all washed up. And bang, just does everything like a machine. Well, that's how I'm living. I'm doing things Danishly now. Because, you know, I kicked and screamed. I went, no, no. When we were first living together, me and my partner, she'd go, look, just please just tidy up. It's just nicer. And I'd go, no, man, I want to live. I don't want to wash up. I want to live. I want to do it all at the last possible moment so I can be stressed about it and live in a dirty house more often than not. Rock and roll. And now I'm bloody washing up before I go to bed. And I'm liking it. Oh, my God. So anyway, the domesticity involved in hoovering the wine rack. Dusting. I've been dusting. It's probably why the allergens have flared up. God, it probably is. Even in defiance of my own biochemistry, I'm tidying gleefully. But I'm sort of mentally clearing up. And it's good. I feel pretty good. I feel pretty happy. And like I said, with the writing of the show, I mean, this is a really good argument for... I always used to come back in September and start writing after like a week. And then the last couple of years, I'd come back in September, have a month off writing. I'd still gig, but I'd not write anything new. And then October, I'd focus on podcast stuff. And November, I'd start writing. And even that has sort of slipped because of the Boutros. And yet I made an unshakable commitment to myself. I'm not going to write for these 2 months, but every single time something strikes me as funny, every thought I have, I'm making a note. And I'm getting up in the middle of the night and making a note. And I'm pulling over to the side of the road and making a note. Or I'm voice dialing my answer phone and making a note on there and then getting it later. I'm making notes. And now I just feel like, oh, hello. Have I shifted up a gear again? I love that feeling. I've been doing some really good work. Sorry, Tamworth. Everywhere else, I've been doing some really good work. And, Tamworth was fine. some gigs have been going, no, this, then this. Yes, that stuff. And some gigs have been going, way! So that is really satisfying to think that, hello, this Hell Week idea of, like, chuck it all out there, rough it all out, there we go, let's get in the studio. You know, I always used to love that when bands at the end of a... You'd listen to, like, a tour recording of a band that was obviously on the last tour. I think I'm specifically thinking, oh, God, sorry to admit this, Counting Crows. Yeah, I know, right? God, I was a huge fan of them. It all went wrong. Anyway, at the end of one of their albums, they're like, okay, bye. We're going to go back into the studio. I love the idea. I was always jealous of a band's ability to go, we're just going to rock out. We're just going to gig. And then there comes a time of year where you go, I'm going back into the studio. And they got to do it with bloody friends, you know, with collaborators. So this is my point. I'm really excited to be back in the studio at the moment and making stuff, feeling good about making stuff. And time will tell. I've got two open spots tonight. I'm doing Old Rope and I'm doing another one at somewhere north for Clara. And I don't know the name of it, so I can't advertise it, but it'll be, I won't have, you know, it's too late now for you to run out and do it because I'm pre-recording this. But, you know, we will see. Time will tell how much of this new autumnal joie de vivre will last when it isn't after two or three really good gigs that involved a bit of new that was cooking. But that's pretty good, guys. I was going to say something else about those pots and pans, but it eludes me for now. So that's that. That's that for now. Was that interesting enough? Don't answer that. Do get in touch at ComComPod if you'd like. Or info at comedianscomedian.com. I feel like we should come up with some sort of Twitter game, but I've not planned it. Do you remember back in the day when we used to do all of that? Do you remember Beta K? I always thought that one should have won. There was a public vote and I stuck to it, but Beta K was definitely the best tribute comedian name. That was fun. Let's. Can we have some suggestions for Twitter games? At ComComPod, tweet me some suggestions for comedy-themed, hashtag-based, inventive games where we all get to make some stuff up that's to do with comedy. You know, remember there was like, oh, you could do like naming your... I did one a couple of times that was like, name your show if it was about war and the sea. Go, what's your show title? That was fun. Should we just do one of those? Let's do one of those. Name your show, your stand-up special, if it is about the work of H.R. Giger. You could look him up. The work of H.R. Giger and anxiety. What's your fringe show going to be called? Let's hear them. At ComComPod on Twitter, and you can give me a hashtag _horse if you fancy saying hello. That's all for now. Oh, I really enjoyed that episode, man. Speak to you soon.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.